Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Debt used to be a word we whispered. Now it's the way we buy what we want. Who can take the credit or blame for that shift? Detroit's automakers.
It wasn't chrome on cars. It wasn't necessarily a new six-stroke engine. Credit was one of their greatest inventions.
General Motors sold America on debt, and now here we are, a nation of credit users. One key to all that credit is a little number called a credit score, and good luck achieving any kind of perfection there.
For a broad section of the population, it probably isn't possible, even if they do everything right.
And even if you could achieve a perfect score, what would you have to show for it?
A couple of years ago, you could walk into a Circuit City and walk out with a $3,000 television set 5 minutes later, even if you had nothing in your pocket.
We'll explore how we became a nation of borrowers in this special hour on credit. It's Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the studios of KWMU in St. Louis, this is Marketplace Money. I have three credit cards, one car loan, a mortgage, and a home equity line. What does that make me? A serial borrower. And a fairly typical one at that. We are a nation of borrowers. We borrow to pay for our homes, our cars, clothing, groceries, gas, movie tickets, chewing gum. And borrowing is a huge part of what got us into this financial mess. Today, we're dedicating the hour to questions of credit, how we got started down this path, and why we thought it would all be okay. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com/new offers.
I'm in St. Louis today as part of a Marketplace series called The Road to Ruin. My colleague Amy Scott and I revisited some of the people and places we traveled to last October. That's when the nation was starting to recognize a new financial order was upon us, including a credit crisis. What better place to begin our education about the culture of borrowing than on a college campus like Washington University, where many people get hooked on credit for the first time? Light from three-story windows and the buzz of lunchtime conversation filled the student union at Wash U. What I didn't see there was one of the staples of my college days in the late 80s, tables of students being paid to hawk credit cards. A few years ago, this university stopped allowing card companies on campus. They didn't want co-eds to be constantly tempted by offers of free T-shirts and football tickets in exchange for signing up for a card. But that hasn't stopped the pipeline from reaching students. The student loan company Sallie Mae reported this week that 84% of the college population uses credit cards.
Yeah, here's a pledge card. Pass the word around. Spread the word to your friends. Thanks.
Jennifer Klein and Taylor Poling are seniors, both hail from Maryland. They were at a table soliciting fellow soon-to-be graduates to contribute to the senior class gift. I asked if either of them knew their credit score, the number that determines your financial identity for the rest of your life.
No, I don't.
Jennifer has a debit card, and Taylor has a credit card. She got her first one as a freshman. She says her parents gave her advice on handling credit, and so far it's worked out.
I make sure that I pay off my credit card every month, and so I'm staying on top of what I can in terms of my own finances.
Around the corner, senior Jonathan Bode of Bloomington, Indiana, and his buddy Ben Walsh, a junior from Cincinnati, were selling tickets to the student musical, Footloose. I asked if they could tell me either their 6 degrees of separation from Kevin Bacon or their credit scores.
Nope.
I don't either.
So 0 for 4 on the credit score. Both said they probably should know. Ben's had a credit card for about 2 years. Jonathan has been an authorized user on his parents' credit card since high school and admits he's gone overboard more than once.
I went through a period where I overused it, and they said, "You're spending too much money." But they never really gave me a limit. I just have a general guilt every time I use it.
When they land on campus, I find that the financial education that they have generally is lacking.
Bill Whitbroat is the director of student financial services at Wash U. He conducts seminars for students to learn how to use credit wisely and the consequences if they don't.
They know about credit cards, but the credit score is usually something, a new concept for them. Hmm. Their credit score is as important as their GPA.
Anyone who's out of school would tell you the credit score is far more important than your grade point average. And credit card companies know that the college student audience is not only somewhat captive, but potentially lucrative. Steve Fazzari teaches economics at WashU.
You have young people who are likely to be, over time, higher earning group because they're getting more education. So you could see, hey, let's get these people with our card, our company, early on. Let's get them hooked in.
But wait a minute, let's give credit a little credit. It does give us more choices in how to use our money. And Fazzari says for college students, it can be a necessity.
If you have a car on campus that needs repair and you don't have the money in the bank, what are you going to do? If the books turn out to be a little bit more expensive than you expected, what are you going to do? So having access to a modest amount of a credit that allows you to smooth your spending relative to your income is something that can greatly improve welfare.
It also allows them to establish a credit history so they're able to do things like rent an apartment. But that assumes they're responsible with the credit they're given. That Sallie Mae survey I mentioned earlier, it found seniors carry an average of more than $4,000 in credit card debt. And that's up almost 50% from just 5 years ago. Fazzari suggests that colleges and universities should provide their own form of credit to students and monitor their usage. It's an idea that might benefit someone like Jonathan Bode, who's about to graduate into a world where credit is his only source of support, aside from his parents.
I'm kind of terrified because I don't have a job, so I just have this magic card that pays for things.
Ah, yes, the magic card. As we'll hear throughout this hour, it's got a not-so-magical history and can hold a powerful spell over your entire financial life. We've got photos of our students, plus some sample handouts from Bill Whitbread's credit seminars on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. American Public Media presents the Poetry Radio Project. You can hear conversations with poets about the economy, music, cooking, and more at americanpublicmedia.org/poetry.
Time to test your own plastic proficiency. As you'll hear later in the show, we go on a search to find out how you get a perfect credit score. So we're curious if any of you come close. Write to us at marketplace.org and tell us your three-digit number. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. So some of those college students we spoke with have had credit cards since high school. The positive spin? You learn credit responsibility early on. But whenever it starts, it's clear we have a love affair with borrowing. Another piece of evidence? The $2.5 trillion the Federal Reserve says Americans now owe in consumer debt. And that doesn't even include mortgages. But just a century ago, the idea of buy now, pay later didn't exist, at least outside of maybe running a tab at the country store. That changed when Americans began another love affair with the automobile. Stephen Smith of American Radio Works takes us through the history of credit.
Back in the 1910s and 20s, factories across the country were pumping out an unprecedented wave of new consumer products.
America, industrial miracle of the century. From all the states flow bounteously the products of forest, mine, and field.
This vintage promotional film celebrates the flood of new durable goods pouring over American consumers, like washing machines, phonographs, radios, and refrigerators. But historian David Farber says there was a problem. Big-ticket items were still too expensive for many middle-class Americans, and there was no such thing as Visa or MasterCard.
There was no consumer credit in the beginnings of the 20th century. There were no credit cards at all. So smart entrepreneurs started to think through the problem. How do you get people to buy things that they can't afford with the money in their pocket?
Cash up front was a particular challenge for middle and working-class people who desired that popular new machine called the automobile. An average family would have to save for about 5 years to buy a car.
Come away with me,
The merry Oldsmobile, along with the Buick and the Chevrolet and other cars, was made by an innovative young company called General Motors.
General Motors was really at the forefront of creating, in many ways, what we think of as modern consumer capitalism.
Here's how GM helped spawn the American way of debt. In 1919, GM was trying to catch up with the world's number one automaker.
The little old Ford, it rambled right along. The little old Ford rambled right along. Now
Henry Ford's Model T was plain, simple, and relatively cheap. It came in one color, black. To buy one, you paid cash up front. GM cars were more colorful and more stylish and more expensive. David Farber says GM gained on Ford by starting a credit war.
General Motors creates automobile loans. 1919, 1920, they create the General Motors Acceptance Corporation. And that allows people to buy more expensive cars by going into debt.
Historian Lendell Calder says the socially conservative Henry Ford scowled at GMAC's auto loan business.
He had older views about whether it was a good idea for Americans to use debt to finance instruments like cars, and he was against it.
Instead of the new-fashioned installment plan, Ford offered customers the old-fashioned layaway plan.
What Ford asked people to do was to bring every week $5, $10, and deposit it in an account run by their local automobile dealer. And then when they had enough money in the account, only then could they take delivery.
Henry Ford thought he knew the American consumer better than executives at GM. But David Farber says Ford couldn't quite see that attitudes about credit and debt were changing.
You had a country in some ways based on the virtues of avoiding luxury, avoiding debt, of being thrifty. And then suddenly in the 20th century, as manufacturers were able to produce so many goods, they begin to wrestle with the possibility, well, maybe it's good to go into debt. Maybe it's good to have luxury items.
Americans gobbled up the newly available credit. By 1930, most durable goods were bought on the installment plan, including more than two-thirds of all automobiles. Soon, Ford dealers were forced to offer auto loans as well. After World War II, the consumer credit business grew at a dazzling pace. By the end of the 20th century, the General Motors Acceptance Corporation had loaned out more than $1 trillion to car buyers. GMAC expanded into home mortgages and other kinds of credit as well. Historian David Farber says that our modern way of buying and borrowing owes a debt to Detroit.
Bottom line, when I look at what General Motors was able to do from the 1920s, at least through the 1980s, it wasn't chrome on cars. It wasn't necessarily a new six-stroke engine. Is that they were inventive. And credit was one of their greatest inventions.
The question now is whether General Motors can reinvent itself. Both GM and its credit arm, GMAC, are struggling with staggering debts. Both companies are running on federal bailout money. They're essentially borrowing their futures from the American taxpayer. This is Stephen Smith for Marketplace Money.
That I'm the coolest thing around. Little buddy gonna shut you down. When I turn it on, wind it up, blow it out, GTO.
GM may be borrowing from our collective future, but we're doing that to ourselves, too. And it's all possible because of one little number that's become synonymous with widely available credit. The FICO score. And before FICO, it was all up to your banker.
If you happen to look like him, white, male, fairly affluent, your chances of getting a loan were much greater than if you didn't.
That story's next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. There are lots of ways to measure the importance of U.S. companies. Largest market cap, ExxonMobil. Most expensive share of stock, Berkshire Hathaway. The biggest influence on your financial life? A Minnesota-based company called the Fair Isaac Corporation. Over the last 30 years or so, Fair Isaac's proprietary credit score, known as FICO, has arguably become the most important number in our lives. Lenders use it to determine whether to loan us money and at what interest rate. Employers use it, so do insurance companies. Marketplace's Janet Babin has the story of one consumer and his credit score that makes you wonder just how fair is Fair Isaac.
I'm about to introduce you to Pete Diebel. He's 35, and when it comes to managing his credit, he's just about perfect. He's rarely missed a credit card payment since college. When he and his wife bought a home in Winter Park, Florida, they qualified for the lowest mortgage rate. They timed the market just right, and
immediately, our property values doubled.
A few years later, they refinanced. Once again, the Diebels' high credit score earned them the lowest interest rate. They tapped their home equity line to pay off their credit card balances, student loans, and new baby expenses. Like I said, Pete was a nearly perfect card-carrying credit risk. Then the financial crisis hit. Banks were forced to clean up their balance sheets. To reduce their own risks, they tightened lending standards for us. Ira Reingold's executive director of the National Association of Consumer Advocates.
Banks and credit card companies are trying to deal with all the bad loans that they've made and are responsible for, and punishing consumers in the process.
Here's how Pete got punished. Without warning, the credit card companies slashed his credit limits. This even though he kept up his payments as he always had. With lower limits, his card balances instantly shifted from making up 20% of his available credit to 80%. Suddenly, Diebel looks like a guy who's living off his plastic. His FICO score dropped 10 points. That may sound minuscule on a scale of 300 to 850, but it could translate into thousands more in interest payments. Diebel didn't find out about the drop until he tried to refinance his home again. Here's what his mortgage broker told him.
Your score is a little lower than you thought it was. And I said, okay. And they also found a couple of things that were collections that literally we'd never seen them before.
Both charges were for medical procedures Diebel says he never even had. Complaints like this are on the rise, creating a backlog. Again, here's advocate Ira Reingold.
Trying to get a credit report fixed is incredibly difficult. Oftentimes, unless you have an attorney helping you, you really can't get bad marks on your credit report removed.
To fix your score, you'll need to deal with at least three leading credit bureaus, TransUnion, Equifax, and Experian. Each company cooks up its own black box of methods to come up with your score. But Bert Flickinger with the Strategic Resource Group says the formula goes something like this.
35% is punctuality, about 30% is the amount of debt, 15% is the length of credit history, 10% is the type of credit used, and the last 10% is recent credit and the amount obtained.
Flickinger says each credit bureau has its own version of your data, and a lot of times that data is wrong. He knows that firsthand. A few years ago, Flickinger bought a condo. Bills for the former tenant's phone service kept coming to him.
My credit score would have been decimated, so I had to make the decision to pay the bills that weren't mine and then request a refund.
While there are no hard numbers on credit bureau errors, advocates say they happen all the time. Steve Wagner with Experian says credit bureaus have to compile bits of information from more than 8,000 creditors. If a consumer complains about an incorrect charge,
we turn around and go back to the data provider and say, is this correct? And if the data provider comes back and says it's correct, then we have to take that as being correct on the file.
Wagner says consumers should check their credit reports every 3 months to look for inaccuracies. But here's the rub. Federal law only requires the companies to give consumers one free report each year. And that report doesn't even have to include your credit score, the FICO number. If you want to see your report more than once a year, you'll have to pay for it. Credit reports were created to simplify the lending process. But Reingold, the consumer advocate, thinks the pendulum has swung too far.
Maybe we should start looking at whether people have enough income to afford this credit and take a look at what their debts are currently.
As for the guy who lost his Gold Star credit, Pete Diebel, down in Winter Park, he's still looking for that new mortgage.
We are going to fix these issues on our credit just as a matter of course. To be honest with you, I'm shopping rates.
Like a lot of us, Diebel may find the lowest possible interest rate just out of reach or available only for a hefty fee. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace Money.
The FICO credit scoring system can be baffling, capricious, illogical, and unfair. It's also a huge improvement over the credit system we used to have.
Liz Pulliam-Weston is a personal finance columnist for MSN and the author of Your Credit Score.
In the 50s and 60s, most credit decisions were made by a banker. If you happen to look like him, white, male, fairly affluent, your chances of getting a loan were much greater than if you didn't. Whole inner-city communities found themselves rejected for mortgages and other loans. Women could often access credit only through their husbands, with no right to loans or credit cards in their own names. The revolution in credit availability didn't really begin until the invention of the FICO scoring formula in the 80s. Lenders had been experimenting with credit scores since World War II, but typically based their formulas on the relatively small group of customers they'd already approved for credit. Lenders didn't know how people who weren't white, male, and affluent might behave, so they remained cautious about extending credit outside that small universe. Engineer Bill Fair and mathematician Earl Isaac answered that question by using a vastly larger database, the millions of credit files stored at the three major credit bureaus. Fair Isaac came up with a formula based on all that information that promised to predict with far more accuracy who was likely to pay their bills and who wasn't. The FICO formula doesn't consider race, gender, or even income. All that matters to FICO is how you've handled credit in the past, particularly the recent past. Armed with FICO's, lenders became much more willing to extend credit across the board. Having access to credit gave millions the chance to own homes, pay for educations, and start small businesses, people who might never have had that opportunity in the pre-FICO era. Perhaps inevitably, lenders took things too far. At the peak of the lending bubble, many lenders stopped looking at anything but FICO scores. They stopped using other measures of risk, such as the borrower's existing debt loads and their capacity to repay the new debt that they were taking on. The result of lenders' irrational exuberance for the FICO score is the financial crisis we're experiencing now. But ditching the FICO isn't necessarily the answer. Despite numerous attempts, nobody's come up with a better formula that lenders are actually willing to use. Anyone who wants to educate herself can figure out ways to improve and protect her score. Knowledge is still power, and I'd rather have that power at least partly in my hands than solely in the hands of some banker behind a desk.
Liz Pulliam-Weston writes about personal finance for MSN.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com/new offers. Marketplace Money is supported by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
Well, in this special look at credit, we've talked to a lot of experts, but now it's time to turn to your questions with our own expert, Chris Farrell. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tess.
So our first question comes from Scott in Cleveland, Ohio, and his credit question is about using credit as a safety net.
Okay.
He's wondering if the suggested 4 to 6 months of emergency living expenses that we talk about quite a bit, if that needs to be entirely in cash. He thinks in an emergency, he could tap his HELOC, his home equity line of credit, and that if he lost his job, he'd get at least a couple of months' pay in unused accumulated vacation time. So what do you think about this notion of thinking of our credit lines as our emergency reserve?
First thing, 4 to 6 months in cash, I think that's a wonderful goal. I think that's great. That's your starting place, your rule of thumb. But now let's get to your question and his question about using the home equity line of credit. Here's the risk. Banks have been cutting back or eliminating home equity lines of credit, home equity loans. They're reducing their exposure. So the way that I like to look at that is it's not part of your 4 to 6 months. You keep working and working to sort of grab that 4 to 6 months. Unused vacation time, absolutely. You know, that's part of your package. You get severance. That's part of it too. But that home equity line of credit, that's a true emergency. You may have to end up tapping into it in a true emergency to tide yourself over. It might turn out that that is your 6 months to 1 year. pot of savings if that's what you're going to have to face. But for the 4 to 6 months, I don't include it.
And what do you think about kind of this general mentality that so many of us have had over many, many years of credit, no matter what form it comes in, as the emergency fund?
As part of your emergency fund, it hasn't bothered me that much. The problem is we're in an economy where the rules are changing. I mean, think about it this way. For a long period of time, it was reasonable that if you lost your job, you would get another job within 3 to 6 months. And our economy now is it's not 3 to 6 months. It's 6 months to a year or to a year and a half before you get another job. All of a sudden, that credit card is not part of your safety net. It's toxic.
Well, Chris, next we have Mark on the phone in Ashburn, Virginia. Hi, Mark.
Hello, guys.
So what's your question for us today?
My question is, I have $30,000 in credit card debt right now. Financially, I'm okay. I can make my payments, but I am considering going to a consumer credit counseling service. And when I've looked at their information, they recommend closing all of your credit cards except for one. And I'm just wondering what happens when you close those credit cards and they have balances on them and how that affects your credit report.
First of all, let's applaud you for looking to get rid of this credit card debt.
It's been a long process. I've been in debt for a long time.
Well, Chris, I will admit on the air here that I have been through this process. So why don't you give your advice and then I'll tell a little bit about my experience.
Okay. If you go to a credit counseling service, it does not affect your credit score. But if you do close accounts, that will affect your credit score a little bit. It'll nick it. But the fact of the matter is you don't really care because what you're doing is far more important. You're getting rid of the debt. So if you go to the National Foundation for Credit Counseling, nfcc.org, it is a legitimate organization. They have outposts throughout the country, set up a credit counseling discussion, sit down and talk to somebody and have them walk you through what the process is, what they can do, and what they can't do for you.
Okay. That sounds like some really good information for me.
And Mark, I'll just tell you, having been through this about 15 years ago myself, it's really remarkable what it does for you to get this kind of help. I learned a lot. And I'm actually surprised that they're going to let you keep one of your credit lines open. For me, they closed all of the cards and then put me on a payment plan. And it never did affect my credit score. In fact, I think it went up after I went through this process. I recommend it, and I wish you the best of luck with it.
Well, that's good to know. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Bye.
Yeah, Tess, I'm really glad you relayed that experience because the important thing is getting rid of the debt. Because if you get rid of the debt and then you set up a good payment history, you're a good credit at that point.
Exactly. Well, we hope you'll give us some credit for answering your questions today. But if you've got something you'd like to run by us, do give us a call. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or write to us. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org, along with Chris's blog with all kinds of answers for you. And Chris, thanks once again for the great advice.
Well, Tess, I'll take the credit this time. Thanks.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. So credit scores can range from a low of 300 to a perfect 850. According to creditinfo.com, some 70% of Americans have a score above 660. Ever heard of anyone with a perfect score? You know, the FICO equivalent of bowling a 300? Is it even possible? Marketplace's Rico Galliano obsessed over that quest.
The other day, on my lunch break, I went online to check my FICO score. I do it twice yearly, of course, because it's a good thing to keep an eye on, but also because I kind of like it, because I've got a nice high score. Ah, 795 out of 850. Now, I have a confession to make. I'm a competitive person, and when I hear the word score, here's what comes to mind.
He's in, he shoots, he scores!
He O'Shea scores! He has scored!
You know, winning. The guy with the higher score wins. And what is a FICO score if not your score in the game called credit? So I challenged my colleagues to a FICO match. Patty Hirsch, senior editor at Marketplace, what is your credit score?
What's a credit score?
No, I'm serious. What is your credit score?
I believe it's 792.
792?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I beat you.
That's because you're 10 years younger than me and you haven't had the chance to make any mistakes.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter for Marketplace and Marketplace Money. What is your credit score?
It's pretty good. It's in this, I think it's like in the 700s.
But is it in the upper 700s?
I don't think it is, no.
So it wouldn't be like, say, above 795?
Rico, no one's score is in the upper 700s.
Mine is. I win. Goodbye. George Judson, managing editor of Marketplace. What is your credit score?
820.
What?
820.
How do you do that?
I've had and paid off 6 mortgages. I pay off my credit cards. I have many, many years of paying bills, I guess.
I have many years of paying bills.
I have more years.
It was a brutal defeat. But here's the thing. George has all that going for him, right? Perfect payment record, long credit history, and he still scored an 820. FICO's top score is 850. So is it even possible to get that score? Is FICO's 850 the fiscal version of that A-plus my college logic professor said he was never going to give out? Because I hated that guy.
I think 850s do exist.
That's not my college logic professor. That's credit expert Jordan Goodman.
They're very rare, becoming more and more rare as the economy slides down.
Are you sure that they exist, or is this just like your hunch?
Well, I have met people who said they've got 850, but I have never actually confirmed it. People, it's not the kind of thing you normally show somebody.
For a second opinion, I asked Greg McBride of Bankrate.com.
Now, if your credit score is above 760, you're already qualifying for the very best rate, so obsessing about pushing it even higher is largely a waste of time.
But that's not my question, Greg. Is that 850 out there? Can I win the FICO game?
I don't think attaining a perfect credit score is possible.
Really? You don't think anybody has an 850?
FICO is the party to ask.
So I did. I went to Oz and I spoke to the wizard, or at least the wizard's spokesman, FICO's PR director, Craig Watts.
In rare circumstances, it is possible to get a FICO score of 850.
That's the good news. Here's the bad.
For a broad section of the population, it probably isn't possible, even if they do everything right.
That's because there's not one formula for calculating your FICO score. There are 10. Each is a scorecard that gives different items in your credit history slightly different weight. Your scorecard depends on where you are in your economic life.
For example, if you are a college student, you're brand new to credit, the FICO formula is only comparing you to other people who also have very short credit histories.
There's a scorecard for people who've been through, say, bankruptcy. They may be printing extras of those these days. But here's the point. Every scorecard has its own score range. If your scorecard's top range isn't 850, you can't get an 850, period. Now, what scorecard applies to you, or when you'll move out of one and into another, that's a secret. All Watts would tell me is how to get the best score possible.
Pay everybody on time. Keep your account balances low on credit cards. Take on new credit obligations sparingly, and then continue managing credit for a long time. Typically, people who score in the mid-800s have been managing credit for at least a couple of decades.
So be a financial rock star and become old.
Yeah, be the Mick Jagger of the credit world.
You hear that, George Judson? Yeah, you with your 820 FICO score? Rematch in 10 years, buddy. Bring your game face. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace Money.
Cal Ripken-style perfection may be a long shot in the credit score game, but riddle me this. The Visa bill comes with charges for scuba gear and tickets to Aruba, but you don't swim and you haven't had a vacation in years. Good luck getting FICO to fish you out of trouble.
The credit bureaus have one customer and one customer only, and it ain't us. It's the banks.
It's up to you to fix identity theft. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. One thing I'm confident no one imagined in the buildup to a culture of borrowers is that one day a stranger would be able to convince debt issuers that they are you with a simple computer keystroke. The wide availability of credit has made it easy for thieves to perfect the criminal art of identity theft. And that means you could be on the hook for bank loans, car loans, and credit cards you don't even own. ID theft costs businesses, banks, and consumers more than $50 billion a year. And once your credit is destroyed, fixing it comes at a high price of its own. Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
David Litchfield is a metal fabricator in Norwell, Massachusetts. David Layton is a repairman in Florida. They've never met, but they know a whole lot about each other. 8 years ago, a man named David Layton started using David Litchfield's social security number.
You get a whole pile of credit cards. They'd use one, max it out, and go to another one.
Litchfield and his wife, Susan, didn't discover the problem until months later when their daughter's student loan was refused. By then, they were sitting on thousands of dollars in overdue bills, and David's credit score was in ruins. It took more than 2 years to repair David's credit, but it looked like the identity thief had been stopped until...
We went to refinance the house, and the bank called me, and I just started crying, and I said, "Don't tell me he's done it again." He goes, "Oh, so it's a mess. Where do you see it?"
Susan Litchfield produces a stack of settlement offers, collection notices, and credit reports, all linked to David Layton. He had racked up more than $200,000 in debt, and it was all there on the Litchfield's credit report.
Credit cards, Capital One, Chase, student loans. He had a $98,000 debt for what we believe was child support.
ID thieves often strike the same victim more than once, says Jay Foley, executive director of the ID Theft Resource Center. He says ID theft is hard to prove. The cases almost never go to court, and the criminals know this.
At the same time that we're dealing with issue A and B, the bad guy is over here creating E, F, and G for us.
The Litchfields have put a stop on their credit, but they're worried David Layton might be sitting on a stockpile of credit cards tied to their accounts, cards he got back when credit was easy. In the meantime, they're still trying to clean up their credit score. And that can be an epic undertaking, says Foley of the ID Theft Resource Center. He says every company where a fraudulent purchase was made has to be contacted via certified mail. Each one has to call off its collections agency, ask the credit bureaus to remove the black mark, and open its accounts to police. Companies often push back so they don't have to cover the damages. Foley says victims should prepare for a fight.
Well, they can expect to be grilled repeatedly. And if there's anything that you say during that process that is ambiguous, they are going to jump on that as the excuse for holding you responsible for the account.
Foley says it usually takes between 6 months and 2 years to correct problems on a credit report. Susan Litchfield says the mess is so big this time, she and her husband have basically given up.
They just bounce you around until after an hour of waiting on the phone, you just hang up. Then I get into bed, my head's spinning, I want to cry. I just get so angry. I get to the point where my blood pressure was sky high. My doctor was afraid I was going to have a stroke. I just put it all away. I just couldn't deal with it.
The credit bureaus don't make things any easier, says Bob Sullivan, author of Your Evil Twin, Behind the ID Theft Epidemic. He says the three agencies that determine your credit score have no incentive to move quickly.
The credit bureaus have one customer and one customer only, and it ain't us. It's the banks. It's the people who lend money.
And lenders are in no rush to see your credit score improve. The lower your score, the more they can charge you to borrow. The Litchfields have seen the interest rates on their credit cards jump and the premium rise for their homeowners insurance. And now David's credit score is so low, he can't even get a card on his own.
I have a credit card that I share with my daughter. Yeah, somehow she got me a credit card that has my name on it, but it's hers and mine.
About 10 million Americans have their identity stolen every year, but there are ways to minimize the damage, says Lucy Dooney. She's with TransUnion, one of the three major credit agencies.
Place a fraud alert on your credit report. You can also place a credit freeze, so no new accounts can be opened in your name.
Dooney recommends being stingy with your social security number and shredding personal documents. ID theft is getting harder, thanks in part to the credit crisis, which has made banks put stricter lending standards in place, says author Bob Sullivan. He blames the era of easy credit for the ID theft boom. He says lenders were more than happy to hand out plastic to almost anyone with very little verification.
A couple of years ago, you could walk into a Circuit City and walk out with a $3,000 television set 5 minutes later, even if you had nothing in your pockets. That's the reality of where we were, and we created this system that made things very easy for identity thieves.
And very hard for people like the Litchfields, who are still dealing with David Layton's debts.
You have one old message.
Good afternoon, David Layton. Just calling about destruction settlement.
I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace Money.
Who's the typical victim of identity theft? Find out in our special web-only feature. You can find it at marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
While identity theft can be incredibly damaging to your credit, we are often our own worst enemies. It all comes down to how we manage our finances and how we should manage them. We asked our own Chris Farrell for a few of his thoughts on our credit culture.
Americans have always had mixed feelings about debt. We praise being thrifty and being frugal, and that's a good thing. We've also borrowed large sums of money since the early days of the Republic. The American dream was bought on the installment plan. Even the Pilgrims had a loan from merchant bankers in London that they had to pay back over time. But over the last decade, we went on a historic borrowing boom. It was more like the American fantasy than the American dream. And as we all know, it had to stop. The boom went bust. Now, the wrong lesson to take away is that all debt is bad. It isn't. But it can be dangerous, really dangerous to your financial health. That's the thing. In all the discussion about debt, FICO scores, credit reports, it's easy to lose sight that credit is a tool. That's it. Nothing but a tool. Like any tool, it can be convenient and useful. Or if you don't know how to use it, you'll flail around and get into deep trouble. There are good reasons to borrow. Many parts of the world, you can't get a mortgage. Instead, you live in a near-permanent construction zone, slowly building your home around you while you live in it for 20 or 30 years. Credit lets us buy a finished home and move in tomorrow. There are bad reasons for borrowing, too, and we've all done it. You know who you are. The Victorians called wasteful borrowing consumptive debt. It's a nice turn of phrase. It captures what we all feel when we carry a balance on our credit cards. What are the right lessons? Take charge of your own finances by saving first. That's key. Know the terms of the loan. Too complicated? Not sure how this loan works? Don't do it. Borrow with a sense of caution. Be careful, especially when the good times roll and the Pied Pipers of credit start singing that buy now, pay later tune.
Several major banks reported better-than-expected earnings this week, but economists are warning that the next big problem is still in the offing. Credit card defaults are at their highest level in 20 years. For lots of folks in deep debt, credit counseling may be the last stop before bankruptcy. Gail Cunningham is with the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. For 16 years, she helped troubled borrowers in Dallas, Texas. Gail, welcome to the program. And let me ask you, you know, we're hearing that this financial crisis is going to change our credit lives forever. You buy that?
Well, possibly. And I'm curious, too, if this new religion of saving and not spending as much is going to stick if the economy turns around. People built a lifestyle beyond which their income could support, and they began to enjoy living large. And hopefully this has been a good financial wake-up call.
So when you've seen consumers come in for help, is there any kind of experience that is common to them? Is there a specific reason they're coming in?
Well, there really are a variety of reasons, but I think one that's terrifically troubling to us, a full 25% of the people who come to us say that the reason for their financial distress is poor money management. They simply don't know how to build a budget, don't know how to live by that budget, and don't understand the most basic financial skills.
Do most of them seem to be in trouble with credit cards?
Yes, the average person that comes to us has 6 credit cards, and it's highly likely that those cards are maxed out because in the previous world of yesteryear, not too long ago, once that card was maxed out, they'd simply go get another one, and it was easy to do. If they couldn't get any more credit, well, they'd scratch their head and go, you know what, I've got some equity in my home, I think I'll pull that out. And of course, you know that both of those doors have been closed to consumers today, and of course, equity in the home, either that equity's already been tapped or the consumer's upside down on the loan and no equity exists.
So do you think we're at a better point? I mean, if credit was really easy to get, now it's difficult to get. Is there a happy medium, or do you think we're where we need to be?
Well, I think that we need to get to a point where we use credit as a convenience. But what's critical is to not charge more than you can pay when that bill arrives. People have buried their head in the sand. If I were to say to someone off the street, tell me your house payment or rent, they'd tell me. Well, what's your car payment? They'd tell me. Well, how much do you spend each month on eating out? Well, I'd get that big deer in the headlights look. People do not track their spending. They don't want to track their spending. They feel that that would be restrictive. But I'm here to suggest that consumers move back over into that driver's seat and take command of their financial future.
For those who have gotten themselves into a little trouble, credit counseling is often a way for them to get out of that trouble. If folks are thinking about coming in to one of your offices, when they knock on the door, what happens?
You know, there's a lot of pain out there, and when someone's hurting, the only thing they focus on is stop that hurting, and that includes financial pain, too. So most of the time when people walk through our doors, they just want that phone to quit ringing at night with the collector on the other end. They want the mailbox not to be so full of collection letters. But there are long-term goals that are addressed in a session, too. But we would start with simply reviewing all income sources. We'd look at their budget, what they're spending on rent and mortgage, food, utilities, etc. Do a pretty thorough intake there of where their money's going. And then, of course, we're going to look at their current debt commitments. Then we're going to see if there's enough money to go around. We may have to have a pretty serious conversation about someone regarding how they are spending their money. And we're going to suggest that they start tracking their money. Anyone can do this for 30 days. Doesn't sound fun, but I know they can do it for 30 days because you can't know where you're going until you know where you are. And if you don't know where all of that money's being spent, then it's time that you saw it in black and white.
What kinds of things can't a credit counselor do? I mean, you're not miracle workers.
You know, as often as we look under our desk for that magic wand, it has yet to materialize. And, you know, we can't create money where none exists. And if someone has debt obligations, and certainly that would include housing, as you might imagine. And back just in 2005, typically we saw about 100,000 people for housing counseling in a year. And in 2008, we saw over 600,000. Unfortunately, we see people that would have been better off, frankly, remaining renters. And we have to deliver some tough love every day. But with that dose of tough love comes the reality that there is life after foreclosure.
And finally, if I may ask, do you own and use a credit card?
I do. You know, this is coming clean here. I have one credit card in my wallet. I use it for everything over $5. I will charge it because I'm addicted to getting my points. But with that said, I don't want anyone else to use me as their standard unless they'll do as I do and pay that bill in full when it arrives each month.
Gail Cunningham is with the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. Thanks so much for being on the show today.
My pleasure.
So one of Gail's suggestions there was to track what you spend for 30 days. If you're game to give it a try and talk to us on air about what you learned from the process, write to us at marketplace.org. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. So at the end of this hour, how are you feeling about your credit life? Credit isn't evil, but it is a rope you can hang yourself with. According to the Census Bureau, by next year, about 180 million Americans will have credit cards, despite the fact that card companies are reining in their marketing efforts. We asked some listeners for a few final thoughts on our credit culture.
My name is Sonia Pichardo. I live in the Bronx, New York. I'm 34 years old. My first experience with credit was when I was a student. I applied for a credit card because a majority of the people who were going to college were doing a lot of fun things like going on vacations. They had automobiles.
My name is Robert Stottlemyre. I am 69. I live in northern Colorado, west of Fort Collins. The first credit card I ever received was in 1964. This was then Sears and Roebuck. Frankly, I was kind of surprised as a student that I was able to get that credit.
My name is Heather Winter. I live in Allen Park, Michigan. I'm 31 years old right now. I got my first credit card when I was in college.
But we strictly used it as a convenience and for emergency purchases.
Up until I got married, I was able to pay off my credit card every month. And then little things just started piling up.
And I felt my senior year was a year that I should enjoy myself. And so I decided that, you know, there were things that I wanted, new clothes.
I'm currently in debt, but we've paid off all our credit cards. We had $51,000 in debt. Now we're down to $23,000, and it includes the home equity loan and my husband's truck. And that'll be paid off in October.
After the first year, I got in a hole of $7,000. Now, I didn't think that was a lot of money because you think, if I don't go to graduate school, I'll get a job and I'll be able to pay this off quite easily.
I think people have abused credit for two reasons. Marketing in this country has been very successful, and what people previously wanted, they've been convinced is a necessity.
I think people find themselves in trouble with credit because you use it without realizing it. I think that's where a lot of people get into trouble, is they're using it to pay bills, and once you start down that road, there is no end to it.
Currently, I follow a plan. Pay down your debts, close all your credit cards, save before you're going to buy something. If you can buy something, buy it cash. If you can't buy it, you can't afford it.
We are determined that we're not going into debt ever again. We've sworn off debt. We will never go back.
That's Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to check out our website for photos and resources for help with credit problems. Next time, Teach for America used to be a career stepping stone. Now it's a good gig on its own.
The payoff is right now that we have a job, because so many people don't.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark, with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Troh. Help this week from Doug Krisner. And special thanks to our hosts here at KWMU in St. Louis. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something from Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers.
American Public Media.